In 1926, the author A.A. Milne wrote a delightful children's book called Winnie the Pooh. And Winnie the Pooh was, and all of the characters in the book were based upon stuffed toy animals that the author had in the bedroom of his son. And his son was named Christopher Robin Milne. The book has been translated into many languages and even into Latin. It's one of the world's bestsellers. It's the only book in the Latin language that made it to the New York Times bestseller list of the top 10 bestsellers. Well, I was a kid. My parents played the old 78 RPM big vinyl records, and they had the stories about Winnie the Pooh, and the narrator would tell all of those. Well, we didn't have television when I was growing up in the early years, but listening to those stories about Winnie the Pooh allowed us to imagine wonderful happenings. And it took us, we could imagine in our minds, in the world of thought, all that was going on. And there was a whole cast of characters. We call them anthropomorphic characters, imaginary characters with human characteristics. So you can see that each of them were, you could imagine them. Piglet was a very affable, lovable little pig, walked on his hind legs. The walked just like a person. There was Tigger, an ever-bouncy and extroverted tiger, bounced around on his tail. You had Eeyore, the woeful, introverted, pessimistic donkey who ate thistles. And then there was Owl and the very nervous rabbit. And, of course, the central character was the ever-hungry Winnie the Pooh, which was the caricature of the boy Christopher Robin's favorite stuffed animal, his teddy bear. Well, these imaginary animal creatures were always getting into one predicament or another. And I do recall a particularly poignant and tender moment, and I'm not sure that it was in the book or if it was in a later Disney movie about Winnie the Pooh, but there was a quiet time when Winnie the Pooh just turned to his best friend and said, "Piglet, are you there?" And Piglet reached out and he held Winnie the Pooh's hand and he said, "Yes, why?" And Winnie the Pooh answered, "I just wanted to be sure." Well, don't we all want that reassurance? To reach out our hand, be able to be close to someone, to have the comfort of a friend, to be able to know that someone is there, as in Winnie the Pooh's words, "I just wanted to be sure." Well, I've entitled to today's message, "The Importance of Being There." The importance of being there. I first thought about this message over 30 years ago, and at the time, I talked to people who were tired. They were just tired. They were spiritually tired, physically tired. They didn't feel as though they had any particular talent or any way to contribute to the congregation or the work of the church. They felt frustrated. Perhaps some were isolated and felt alone. And particularly, of course, I was up north, grew up up north, and in the wintertime, people would leave for work or school. It would be dark out in the morning, and it would often be dark when they got home late in the afternoon. Well, that's about 600 miles north of here. And, of course, there's less daylight hours than what we have here in southwest Missouri. But the days became shorter, and the nights were longer. And then some people, during the winter, they felt discouraged. There's even a name for that type of discouragement. It's called seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, S-A-D. Well, according to one study, SAD occurs in 1.7% of the population in Florida. Not a surprise, not very many, but 9.5% of the people in Maine and other northern states and northern countries such as Finland. And we do have church members in Finland, indeed northern Finland. The United Nations has resettled because of the civil war in Southeast Asia they had that of the Karen Hill people. We have church members who lived in a refugee camp for 20 years and gladly took to any place to get out of there so they wouldn't have to suffer. And so the United Nations sent them from Southeast Asia to northern Finland. So they had a place. And they sent the kids to Canada. And a sister-in-law to Norway. So it's good to know those people, but now they're working in their fourth and fifth languages when we see them at the feast. There was a lady in church that I knew as a young man. She was so stricken in Minnesota that she rarely left her house. About 6% of the people nationally are subjected to SAD, seasonal affective disorder, and about 1 out of 5 people are affected by mild winter blues. Well, people become uncertain about themselves, and they really need the reinforcement about someone. They want someone to tell them that they're worth it, that they want to know, that they just want to be sure. And so today I'm going to look at a few biblical references of people who had those same thoughts. They were unsure of themselves and what their situation was. And then we'll look at 7 points what God expects of us to provide when he provides us reassurance. Well, in the spring, summer, and fall, the holy days are pretty exciting when people get together for those special occasions. But there's a 6-month period between the fall holy days and spring, and it's harder to get reassurance there, but there's ways to do that. We also need reassurance because we are a relatively small group. Now, I have a small flock of sheep. There's a ram and 6 ewes, and this year we had 10 baby lambs here in the last month. 6 of them had twins, and or rather 4 had twins, 2 had singles. And sheep are a flock instinct animal. You don't see them very, very rarely off alone. They usually stick together. They don't do well all alone. You don't have, like cattle, you can say, well, there's a cow got out. Not with sheep. Either they're all got out or perhaps none of them got out. They just follow through. In Luke 12:32, Jesus Christ referred to his church as a little flock. In Luke 12:32, fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And the people that God, or who are people who are answering God's call at this time, we don't see them gathering by the millions or the billions, but there are small groups of people all over the world. And they collectively add up to thousands and thousands of believers. And the small groups everywhere need that reassurance that somebody is there. But let's think back to a very early Christian. And there is somebody, the Bible records, who responded to the call of God, and he was definitely a minority in his time. And to make matters worse, this man was told to take his wife and leave home and move away. And they moved several times. Finally, they traveled many miles away from the land of their birth. And I'm referring to Abram, who was later be called Abraham, and his wife Sarah. Now, Abraham didn't have a big congregation to encourage him every Sabbath. He had to rely on God for his spiritual sustenance as well as his physical well-being. Ultimately, God blessed Abraham, and he is referred to in Hebrews 11 as faithful. I couldn't find any reference in the Bible to the term father of the faith. Well, he's often referred to that because his son, grandson, and great-grandson were very faithful to God's way. Abraham knew what it was like to be alone. Yet he listened to God's instructions for his life, and God made him a spiritually and physically wealthy man. Now, Scripture records another man who came along with Abraham from the land of Abraham's birth, and Abraham's nephew Lot. It was Abraham's brother's son, and it appears that Abraham was responsible for perhaps his brother had died, but responsible for young Lot. And Lot was blessed just by being close to Abraham. But eventually, and we read in Genesis 13, that Lot and his herdsmen, and because they grew great flocks and rich in livestock, were conflicting with Abraham's flocks. So they decided that they would part ways. And if we read in Genesis 13:12, that Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So they separated, and they said, well, it was a congenial thing. We'll separate so our herdsmen don't fight over access to water or pasture and so forth. And yet God decided that the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah was so great that those cities must be destroyed. They were incorrigible. And then we read in Genesis 18 that Abraham bargained with God to try to save Sodom and Gomorrah. And, you know, hey, if there's only 50, would you save them? Oh, what if it just lacked 5 and 45? And he kept bargaining with God. When he got down to 10, ultimately, and if there were only 10 left, God would withhold the destruction. But there weren't 10 righteous men left, or righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And we can infer that because Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. And an escaping Lot must have felt the heat of the fire of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. 44 years ago, in fact, 44 years ago and 1 week, I was living in 1980, I was living in Eugene, Oregon. And about 140 miles straight north of there, in the state of Washington, a volcano erupted at 10:30 in the morning on a Sunday morning. It was May 18th of 1980, and the top third of Mount St. Helens blew off, exploded, and the blast was so strong that one third of the mountain was turned into volcanic ash. And that was a whitish, light gray in color, and it resembled powdered glass, and it was spread from the west across the state of Washington to the east and went into the upper atmosphere and as far as Minnesota. Now, I caught a plane from Oregon to Minnesota shortly after that, and I'm in the airport in Minneapolis, St. Paul Airport, and I heard the pilots that were getting off the same plane I was on, and they said, wow, did you see how those engines looked like they were all sandblasted? Because the powdered glass that was up in the upper atmosphere affected the engine as well. I drove through that a year later from Oregon to Minnesota, and it looked like there were receding snowdrifts in the road ditches as I drove across central and eastern Washington, hundreds of miles from the volcano. People told stories about how they survived the blast of Mount St. Helens. One church fellow who was camping nearby when the mountain blew said that he could not see the hand in front of his face. It's not like it was because it was the cloud was everywhere. There was a t-shirt maker in Oregon. He saw an opportunity to make a few bucks. So he made t-shirts, and across the front it said, I survived Mount St. Helens. The back of the t-shirt was ragged and full of burned holes. Okay, so across the front it looked pretty obvious, as though the wearer had been wearing it on that day. And then I thought of Lot, who escaped the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, running away, leaving everything behind. Now he had to have seen the glow in the sky of the destruction, because when we can look out on the horizon, we can see up to 40 miles to where the curvature of the earth bends. And you can still see the reflection on the clouds beyond that. As a boy, I remember in south central Minnesota, we could look in the sky and we could see the city lights from each of the cities. So you could look in one direction, you could see the lights there in this direction. You could even see the Twin Cities 60 miles away, big light in that direction. And so it's reasonable that Abraham then would have known that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah had occurred just by looking at the glow from that far away. And it had to have given Abraham a heavy heart to realize that his nephew Lot may have perished in the destruction. But then you think about, what about Lot? How did he feel to be spared, fleeing the city and saved alive when all of his neighbors perished? Because there was presumably fire and brimstone that came around him. And we read in Genesis 19:21, his daughters apparently thought no one else on earth was left alive because it was destruction all around them. They felt alone. So each of these that we're talking about, they felt desperately alone. 1,000 years later, there was a shepherd boy and anointed to be a future king. His name was David. He was on the run to keep King Saul from killing him. And David had become an outcast, living on the edge of society, and the power of the state, the might of the state, was coming and could come and pounce upon him on a moment's notice. And most of us know, are familiar with the 23rd Psalm and how it exudes peace and comfort and God's protection. But how many of us turn to the Psalm 22, the one just before it? And if we read that in Psalm 22 and we go through that, and particularly verse 12, the bulls of Bashan surround me. In other words, all of his troubles were represented by the bulls of Bashan. Bashan was a grassy wilderness area, raised a lot of cattle. And if you've seen the videos or you grew up on a farm with a bull with horns, it isn't a pretty sight to be caught in the middle of those. You're in a world of hurt. So he relied on God for his protection, but he felt alone with just those wild bulls ready to take him out. And then his son, King Solomon, we turn to Ecclesiastes in chapter 1. King Solomon had 40 years of peace and all the riches and pleasures of the world, and yet he felt empty and said, what's the use? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 14. I've seen all the works which you have done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Ever try to grab the wind? How's that work out? Okay, meaning it was empty. Ecclesiastes 2:17, he repeated, therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me for all its vanity and grasping for the wind. We have King Solomon did not feel fulfilled in this life. That he had everything, and yet he was still feeling very much alone. We read in 1 Kings 18, we read about Elijah the prophet. And Elijah the prophet, this was in the northern kingdom of Israel, not the southern kingdom of Judah, after the divided kingdom. And we had the wicked Ahab and the wicked Jezebel were after him. And they had meant to destroy all believers that they could find. And Elijah the prophet thought he was the only one left, you know, I alone. Thought he was the only one still worshiping God. Hundreds of priests had been killed by Jezebel, and Elijah was hiding for his life. But unbeknownst to Elijah, there were 7,000 people who continued to be faithful to the true God, including, interestingly enough, Obadiah, who was the chief servant of King Ahab's household. We can read that in 1 Kings 18, verses 5 through 16, or 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 10. But he didn't know, but Obadiah was hiding priests, hundreds of them in caves, during a drought, giving them food and water when it was hard to find. But he had the authority under King Ahab, right under his nose, and was able to do that. But Elijah didn't know that. He thought he was it. This is it. The world is reduced to me. There are many others, and I'm sure there are biblical examples of people who felt they were alone at times, and people wondered, how could they ever be used by God? And the Bible is full of those kinds of stories. We can read about Jacob, son of Isaac, who was on the run. First, he was on the run from his brother Esau. Later, he escaped the grasp of his father-in-law, Laban. But he was on a run, in each case, afraid for his life. Jacob's son Joseph, sold into slavery, cast in a pit, falsely accused, thrown into prison. He's probably feeling pretty alone at each one of those stages, very much alone. Many years later, we have Moses, who had to flee Egypt to save his life because he recognized that he was of Hebrew descent, and he claimed it, and then spent 40 years in the wilderness. Now, I don't know how many of you have spent 40 years in one place, doing something for which you had no background or training on how to do, incidentally, and becoming a shepherd. And the Egyptians hated shepherds. It was a bad representation for them. And so he spent 40 years in the wilderness before then going back to Egypt. I think of Joseph's life. is summarized with the letter P. Thrown in a pit, then he went to Potiphar's house, then he went to prison, then he went to Pharaoh's court, then he wound up in a pine box and said, take my bones back to the promised land. And then Moses, you can summarize his life into three parts of 40. First 40 years in Pharaoh's court, the next 40 years in the wilderness, and then the next 40 years leading the children of Israel out of Egypt and into the wilderness. Each one of those had their very lonely moments. Then there was Daniel. He was a captive prince of Judah, and he was hauled away to a strange land. And he decided to worship God despite the new law that forbid the worship of the true God. And we have then, there were 11 surviving disciples of Jesus Christ. And if we read, and as we read through history, and it appears that all of them suffered martyrdom, except one, okay, and John, who wrote the book of Revelation. And they all had their periods of discouragement, and they needed that reassurance. The Winnie the Pooh story hadn't been invented yet to tell them, but they needed that assurance that somebody was to be there. Now, 50 years ago, I was a young man in Spokesman's Club. I was young once, just for the record. And I was in Spokesman's Club with a fellow who was about a dozen years older than I am, and he had just come into the church. And his wife had left him and moved hundreds of miles away with to his two daughters. And he was feeling horribly despondent, the utter agony of separation, and the pain of coping with a more than difficult situation. And, you know, I was a college student. Well, I didn't, you know, you did the best you can. I wasn't, you know, a young single guy. I couldn't imagine the depth of what he was going through. And it was 20-some years later, I had a heavy trial in life. And the agony of that trial seemed heavier than I could bear. But I dragged myself to church every week, and I started to feel a connection with Job, you know, my buddy Job. Everything that seemed to have gone wrong, except for the boils part. I wasn't real fond of the boils. I was glad I didn't have those. But there was a man who came to church that was that same man I knew back in Spokesman's Club, and he just stood beside me. He didn't say much. He just stood there. He didn't unload lots of advice on me or wave a magic wand or sprinkle me with pixie dust and tell me how much wonderful life was going to be. You know, he was just there for me. I will never forget that he had the friendship of Winnie the Pooh and Piglet by just being there. And I look at those two times when my friend was going through the difficult times, and I was new in the church. I didn't know how to help him. I didn't understand the value of just being there. I didn't feel his pain. But when later, he knew, he understood how to be a quiet comfort for me. And many years have passed. We still keep in touch from time to time. And I'm pleased to call him my friend. But he was the one that taught me the value of being there. Well, there are 7 points today about the importance of being there. That I want to cover. And the first one is, by being there, we are fulfilling an expectation of God. God says, I will never leave you or forsake you in Hebrews 13:5. He tells us that directly. Hebrews 13:5, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content for such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. You know, Moses was 120 and saw the promised land afar off. And God gave Moses the assurance that the children of Israel could enter that land. And it's interesting, when we read in Hebrews 11 or 13:5, we read, I will never leave you or forsake you. They're really quoting from Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. Be of courage, strong and of good courage. Do not fear, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. So that was the message to Moses. Well, we can rely on God because we know that his laws are for our benefit. God hasn't abandoned the laws of gravity or the law of inertia or other laws of physics, such as the tetrahedral bond of carbon atoms into molecules. And if we didn't have that law of physics, without such life as we know it simply would not exist. And God hasn't abandoned his physical laws, and neither has he abandoned his spiritual laws. Now, here's what God expects from us. In Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 16, he says, "Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy." Holy means set apart, special. In Luke 10, verse 27, another of God's expectations is, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind." Interesting, he also says, "And love your neighbor as yourself." Interestingly, that appears 9 times in the Bible, Old and New Testament, about loving your neighbor as yourself. And if you don't love yourself, love God first and love yourself, you're not in a good position to be able to love your neighbor. So to show that we love God, then, we keep his commandments in 1 John 5:3. In 1 John 5:3, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." Actually, you can read the whole book of 1 John, has that reinforcing principle. Each Sabbath is an opportunity to show our love for God. In Matthew 22:37, Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind." It's again repeated that this is an opportunity to do so. And there are benefits for being at Sabbath services each week, which brings us to point number two. Point number two is, by showing up at church each week, we have the opportunity to provoke each other to good works. We have the opportunity to provoke each other to good works. In Hebrews 10, starting in verse 24, I'm going to read this in the King James. "Let us consider," in Hebrews 10:24, "let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." Notice the word provoke each other to good works. And I like the way then the New King James puts it, that verse. I wanted to read the King James and compare it to the New King James, because I think the New King James might more accurately convey, because provoke sometimes has a negative connotation. In the New King James, it says, "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." When you're cooking and the recipe says, "Stir occasionally," why? So stuff doesn't burn to the bottom, right? Stirring it up for getting the best results. It rolls on, "Stir up love and good works, and not forsaking the assembling of yourselves." So these things are tied together, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together and the provoking to good works. Now, sometimes we all need a poke. And the extra oomph we get from keeping the Sabbath that God has reserved for our benefit. I don't know, is oomph even a word? Hopefully you know what I mean. Now, we can use it or we can lose it. And that involves physical muscles or spiritual muscles. So the implication of Hebrews 10, verses 24 and 5, that, well, if we don't assemble together, then we're not in a position to be able to provoke or stir each other up to good works. So then point three, by showing up each week, we are in a position to help others. By showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. In Matthew 18, verse 20, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I'm there in the midst of them." Now, I'd mentioned earlier about Ahab and Jezebel, and their governor of the king's palace was Obadiah. He was faithful to God. It was a tough situation. You can imagine if he'd have been found out, they would have given him nasty torture, maybe disassembled his body a little bit at a time, as an example. But he saved hundreds of priests in caves and fed them, not a meal, not a day, not a week, not a month, not a year, but for 3.5 years of the drought. He was in a position to be able to help others. That's, of course, in 1 Kings 18. We read in the book of Esther, and we'll go to the verse 414, but Esther was faithful to God, and she became the queen of Ahasuerus, the leader of the Medes and Persians. Ahasuerus was the emperor of the land between India and Ethiopia. That's a long ways, folks. Look on the globe. That's a huge area. And it was Esther, her Hebrew name was Hadassah, her cousin and guardian, Mordecai, noted that Esther was in a unique position to help others. In Esther 4:14, when Mordecai said, "Who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Now, do you suppose Esther felt alone? She's surrounded by heathens, swept up into royalty by choice of the emperor or the king. And yet, those words of Mordecai should ring in our ears, because we don't know necessarily what's coming next, but perhaps each of us is in a position to help someone. We don't know the needs of others. If we don't know them, how can we help them? So simply by being there, we can come to know our church family, how we can help others, and let others know that we would appreciate their help. I remember being in a tough spot, and my brother in the church says, "Well, if you don't say anything, how will we know? How can I help you with that?" I was going to be real prideful and just tough it out and crash and burn. But he was there for me. Point four, by showing up each week, we raise our own level of expectations for ourselves. Now we can go through Matthew 25. And I have down, and I'm not going to read them all, verses 14 through 30, because it's a description of the parable of the talents. Even if we only have one talent, in other words, one thing that we can offer, one thing that we can invest, one thing we can do, the instruction in this is we're to use it wisely, use it effectively, and not sit on it, not do it. But how do we know if we're in a place that we can use that, or if we are able to help someone unless we go there to help them? So we are reminded to be aware of our opportunities to serve God. And many other people come before us to provide for our spiritual growth. I know that when my wife first came in the church in Oklahoma, this is almost 50 years ago, her mentor was Mrs. Steele. Some of you may know her. And I'm going, because somebody came before us and to make it possible for us to be there, to guide us along the way, to help us out. So, I mean, who would have thought just a few weeks ago that, or a week ago, that we would be assembling under these circumstances? Life happens, it changes, and we have to be prepared to say yes, because we're all necessary parts of the body of Christ. Well, that takes us to point five. By showing up each week, we provide strength to the spiritual mother, the church, by making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. The church is referenced in Scripture, 1 Thessalonians 2:7, we'll turn to. The church is referenced in Scripture as a mother. And as members of the church, we're to provide for those who come to the church for refuge. The Apostle Paul then writes to his congregation in Thessalonica in 1 Thessalonians 2:7. "But we were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children." Now, as we know, a nursing mother has a special relationship with her child and a loving care, a bond. And so we too, as church members, as part of the mother, are to be caring for others. Now, we know that our church has needs, and that by sharing then the burden makes a lighter burden for everyone, not just a physical burden, but the emotional burdens as well. So we can be part of that gentle nursing mother comforting each other. Point six, by showing up each week, we encourage others by our example. By showing up each week, we encourage others with our example. And one way to do this is by worshiping God through our music. In Psalm 13, verse 6, the psalmist writes, "I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." We read in our hymnal, hymn 58, "Sing to the Lord with a cheerful voice." It's an opportunity to raise praise and honor and thanks to God. A verse that's often overlooked is Psalm 61 and verse 1, because we always hear if somebody says, "Well, I can't sing." Well, and I've taken the tests, you know, the Johnson O'Connor aptitude tests, and I'm at the 5th percentile on rhythm memory. You would have to be drunk or crazy to think I could lead songs. Just not going to happen, because dancing and song leading are really not my strength. Okay, but what does it say in Psalm 66, verse 1? "Make a joyful noise unto God." Wow. So at minimum, we can come and bring a positive attitude and make a joyful noise. In Psalm 81, verse 1, "Sing aloud to our God, our strength, make a joyful noise to the God of Jacob." Psalm 95, verse 1, we hear this repeated. "Come, let us sing to the Lord and make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation." Psalm 95, 2, "Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise to him with psalms." So if you hear me, you'll know that I'm doing my best to make a joyful noise. Now, there are, on the aptitude test, they measure aptitudes from the Johnson O'Connor. They have 19 inherited aptitudes. You got to have three of them really strong in three areas to be a concert-level musician. One of them is rhythm memory, which is I'm at the 5th percentile, so 95% of the people are better than I am in that area. But then there's also pitch discrimination and melody or tonal memory. So I'm okay on the other two. So I can kind of trot right along with y'all, as long as the song leader keeps me on the same verse. And then point seven. By showing up each week, we give less opportunity for Satan to influence our thinking. By showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. You probably heard the old saying that idle hands are the devil's workshop. So what would we do if we didn't go to church and focus on the Sabbath each week? Would our activities take us away from learning more about God and his ways? Would we spend a little more time on the job and watching television or studying school lessons or pursuing sports activities, whether as a participant or an observer? Would we spend time focused on our own pleasures that draw us away from God? There's a young man I know who considers our church his church, but he's addicted to sports, and he can't actually make it in the door because his sports addiction prevents him, but he still wants to be with us. He wants to want to, if I can use that term, to be with it. But he has other things. The barriers are there. There are barriers that will draw us away from God. We read about King Solomon in 1 Kings 11:1. Solomon loved many strange women. And what happened? They turned his heart after their gods. So Solomon's heart was drawn away. Doesn't mean the women were strange in the sense that, you know, they had, you know, three noses and antenna grown out of their head or something. No. It just means that they did not believe in the true God. And everybody, as a human, has a weakness. That happened to be Solomon's weakness. But do we allow Satan to feed our weaknesses? Well, just by being there for each other every week, we can reinforce then each other and our belief in the true God. And then we can be strengthened ourselves by God working then through other people. Well, the opportunities to depart from God's expectations are endless. In Job 1 and verse 7, in Job 1 verse 7, the Lord said to Satan, "Where do you come from?" And Satan answered and said, "From going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it." Whoa, there is a monster that is hunting and crawling and looking for your weaknesses and my weaknesses and seeking to accuse us. In Revelation 12 and verse 10, we read about this accuser in Revelation 12, 10, and I heard a loud voice in heaven, or saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of the brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. Did before Job, and so we know that that's true everywhere we look. Well, what's the solution? In James 4 and verse 7, we are given a key. In James 4 and verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Well, in this resistance, well, this drawing close to God means that following God's instructions on a daily basis, surrounding yourselves with like-minded believers. And I recall HWA's observation that to get air out of a glass, you have to fill that glass with water, forcing then the air out. So we can resist the devil and his temptations by staying close to God each week, filling up our spiritual glass of water. And when we're filled with God's Spirit, we're better able to resist Satan. In Luke 4, 8, Jesus Christ rebuked Satan. In Luke 4, 8. And Jesus answered and said to him, get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. That was a direct rebuke. We can do that too if we are being plagued by any of those influences. We can simply quote that Luke 4, 8 and do what Jesus' example was. One of the ways we are able to refill our spiritual glasses each week is simply by being there. We should never underestimate the importance then of being there. In 1995, I was overjoyed to see so many old friends and acquaintances at our first of our big combined Holy Day services. And it was a couple of years ago, I went to my uncle's funeral up in Minnesota, and for church that weekend, I went up to Fargo, North Dakota. That's where I gave my first sermonettes in the Fargo congregation in 1979. And I was there 43 years later, and I gave my first couple of sermonettes up there, and I went back, and there were six people in the congregation that had heard my first sermonette, and there were another six that were online watching on the web that day, and it was a delight to know that those dozen people were still strong, they were still faithful, and that I was encouraged by them, and they felt very positive that somebody they knew, one of their babies, as it were, because I was a young man at that time working at the university, and so we could appreciate and be encouraged by each other. So the 7 points on being there. Number one, by showing up each week, we're fulfilling an expectation of God, which is remember the Sabbath to keep it holy or special. Number two, by showing up each week, we can provoke or stir others up others to good works. Number three, by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. Number four, by showing up each week, we raise the level of expectation for ourselves. Number five, by showing up each week, we're providing strength to our spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. Number six, by showing up each week, we encourage others with our example, whether in song or in service. And number seven, by showing up each week, we give less opportunity for Satan to influence our thinking. Just as the make-believe Winnie the Pooh asked Piglet if he was there, and Piglet reached out his hand, Winnie the Pooh expressed deep need in all of us when he said, I just wanted to be sure. So let's reach out our hand to others, simply to be there for them, so they can be sure. Thank you for your invitation. Looking forward to, if I haven't met you yet, I look forward to seeing everybody today. And good to see you next time.